funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does eating foie gras make you complicit in the torture of animals? The fatty organs of ducks and geese have been a prized treat on human tables for thousands of years, and waterfowl have been deliberately force-fed at least since Egyptian cooks discovered that birds who overate yielded the tastiest livers. But while this costly dish has been served in the U.S. for centuries, it didn't garner much attention until 4 years ago, when a series of articles by Chicago Tribune reporter Mark Caro made public the facts about foie gras production methods and the searing debate over its impact on the animals themselves. Mark Caro writes about what he discovered in a new book called The Foie Gras Wars, How a 5,000-Year-Old Delicacy Inspired the World's Fiercest Food Fight. Mark, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
This all started for you, I guess, with a really killer quote from Charlie Trotter, the chef, who had once happily served foie gras and then had a change of heart.
Right, yeah. I mean, Charlie Trotter from Charlie Trotter's, which is the name of the restaurant, I mean, was really considered, you know, perhaps the top chef in Chicago and one of the top chefs in the country. And he was one of these American chefs who had really actually helped popularize foie gras, and that it was known as a French delicacy. And, you know, there were chefs like himself and Thomas Keller and Wolfgang Puck who really made it more of like an American thing that you would find in these upscale restaurants. And at some point he had a change of heart. And he told me in 2005 that in 2002 he'd quit serving it because he just thought it was too, you know, it was too cruel and ducks didn't need to go through this. And granted, in 2001, he had a book called Charlie Trotter's Meat and Game that actually had 14 foie gras recipes in it. So this was a pretty dramatic shift for him.
Mm-hmm. And so you went around and asked other chefs what they thought about that.
Exactly. So what I did is I called a lot of the other top chefs in Chicago and in the Chicago area. And the French one said, look, you know, if we took this off the menu, it would be the customers who would suffer, and I come from farms, and it's not cruel to the ducks. And I talked to a chef named Rick Tremonto, who actually used to work with Trotter years earlier and has a restaurant called True, which is also one of the top restaurants in Chicago. And he said, you know, it's a little hypocritical. Either you're eating animals to eat them, kill them and eat them, or not. And I called Trotter back and just said, look, I just talked to these other chefs, and this is what they said, and this is what Rick Tremonto said. And Trotter says, well, Rick Tremonto's not the smartest guy on the block. Yes, animals are raised to be slaughtered, but are they raised in a way where they need to suffer to then be slaughtered for the pure enjoyment? He can't be that dumb, is he? What's up with that? It's like an idiot comment. All animals are raised to be slaughtered. Oh, okay, maybe we ought to have Rick's liver for a little treat. It's certainly fat enough.
And there started the whole thing.
Yeah, well, for me at least, because I'm sitting there and I have my tape recorder running and I'm sitting at my desk at the Tribune, and I thought, wow, he might have put duck livers on the front page of the Tribune. And it could have been just this kind of fun, gossipy little item about the two top chefs and one of them wants to eat the other one's liver. But as I looked more into it, I found the issue itself fascinating, and I realized that just a few months earlier, California had banned the production and sale of foie gras, but only taken effect in 2012. And I spoke to Guillermo Gonzalez, who runs Sonoma Foie Gras, which is the only foie gras farm in California, and he was saying, look, you know, this is all part of the vegan agenda. There are only three foie gras farms in the country. We're not an industry. We don't have any lobbying muscle, and it's very easy to pick on us because, you know, it's this French delicacy. It's for rich people or foodies. It's, you know, it's expensive, and it does this thing to a duck where you're force-feeding the duck, and you're making this liver balloon to, you know, 8 to 10 times its normal size. And, of course, people are going to recoil against that. But, in fact, this actually isn't torturous to the duck. It's not mean to the duck. And, you know, they're picking on us as part of a greater issue. And I also spoke with Michael Gannor at Hudson Valley Foie Gras, and I spoke to Gene Bauer at Farm Sanctuary, who basically said, yes, you know, I mean, we do think it would be better if everyone were a vegan, but at the same time, you can't excuse force-feeding an animal and making its liver swell up like that. And I found both arguments to have their own logic behind them, so I wrote it up, and it became, I mean, I'm someone who writes about entertainment for the Tribune normally and covers the Oscars and is reviewing movies and stuff like that, and, you know, my duck liver story got a lot more attention than, you know, Tom Cruise or Nicole Kidman or any of those people. It's just everyone chimed in on this thing.
Did this whole thing anchor Charlie Trotter's public and political stake in the issue to a greater degree, do you think, than might have happened otherwise?
Well, it's interesting because Charlie Trotter he's not a particularly upfront political kind of guy. You don't see him testifying for bills. And in fact, he really stayed out of it when Joe Moore, an alderman in Chicago, read my story in the Tribune and proposed that the city ban it. And Charlie Trotter's a libertarian, and he doesn't think there should be any laws against it. And in fact, he said that in my original story. So he pretty much has kept a low profile since that, even though his quotes, I mean, he knew what he was saying, and in the middle of it, he said to me, you should quote me on that. And, you know, when I followed up with him a couple weeks later, he was saying, you know, sometimes you have to open a can of whoop-ass. So he was he's very conscious of what he's doing, but at the same time, he tries not to be political. And, you know, when I would talk to him later, he would say, look, I'm just a chef trying to do my business. But there were a lot of people who were interpreting what he did, and that you had chefs such as Anthony Bourdain, who really felt like he was betraying the cause, because at that point, he really was the highest profile chef to say, look, I'm not going to do this. Now, since then, Wolfgang Puck, who was getting pressured a lot from animal rights people, turned around and took foie gras off of all of his menus. Michael Gannor at Hudson Valley Foie Gras was saying, look, Charlie Trotter is a very astute marketer, and he saw which way this issue was going, and he tried to get out in front of it. You know, Charlie Trotter said, no, there are just too many other good things to eat, and we shouldn't have to eat this.
How much of this stuff are Americans eating every year anyway?
Well, relatively speaking, very little. I mean, if you look at the foie gras farms, again, there are three main farms in the U.S., and there's one very small one in Minnesota as well, and they produce 500,000 ducks a year. And the chicken industry produces 9 billion chickens a year.
And that's just domestically?
Yeah, it's just domestically. That's just, you know, your broiler chickens. And so like one big chicken plant will do 500,000 in a day. I mean, it's, and, you know, the thing is, too, that it's not just the foie gras. They do sell the rest of the duck. So if you go to a restaurant and you get duck confit, a lot of times that will be, you know, the leg of that same duck because it's in the fat. Or if you go somewhere that has duck fat fries, it'll probably be that duck. Or a Magret breast. A Magret is the breast of a foie gras duck. So it, even in Chicago when they did ban it, they banned the liver, but then you could go, the one place that got fined in all of the city of Chicago is this hot dog place called Hot Doug's, where this guy was just poking the bear, and he had a foie gras sausage on there after the ban called the Joe Moore, which was named after the alderman in Chicago who had pushed the ban. And they came in, and they confiscated his foie gras and put it in an evidence bag and tagged it and put it in his freezer and told him not to touch it and fined him $250, which was about the most cost-effective advertising in the history of advertising, I think. But at the same time, every weekend, people were lining up, and they still do. Fridays and Saturdays, he serves duck fat fries. And they come from the same place. They come from Hudson Valley Foie Gras and LaBelle, which is one of the other farms. So there are all these like little gray areas where you say, okay, well, this is banned, but this is okay. And, you know, the treatment of this, you know, this treatment of this duck sounds bad, but on the other hand, we don't really want to know how, you know, the chickens that lay our eggs are treated or the chickens that we eat at McNuggets are treated. And so it's just, all these cans of worms get opened up. And for me, that's what I found fascinating, because I'm one of these people who tries to be the so-called ethical omnivore and, you know, doesn't want, you know, animals to suffer more than they have to when I eat them. But at the same time, it's very hard to cut that ethical path if you're trying to eat some things and not eat other things and you don't really know where things are coming from.
Why do you think this has resonated with so many people who might not have been even acquainted with other people who were eating foie gras?
Right. Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think there are two main reasons. I think one of them is that it's ducks, and I think we have a more emotional reaction to ducks than we do to, say, chickens. I mean, ducks, you'll see if you live in big cities and you have make way for ducklings, you'll see them in ponds, and you have Donald Duck and Daffy Duck and the Aflac Duck, and there's some study that says if you're going to tell a joke with any animal in it, it should be a duck. And so the idea of something being done to a duck, I think, troubles people. And especially when it's something so vivid as it being, you know, a tube that is put down the duck's throat and it's force feeding it and it's making its liver swell up. And we think that sounds like torture. And we sort of don't really stop to think, well, all right, how are ducks, you know, biology different from us, and they swallow whole fish, and they store fat in their livers and under their skins, and they migrate, so they gorge themselves, though not to that extent. So there's the duck thing, and then there's the whole kind of collective deniability thing, where, again, I think that it's very, you can look at this issue with a safe distance. You could say, oh, it's ducks, and I don't eat that many ducks, and that really sounds horrible, and they just shouldn't be treating, you know, animals that way. But by the way, I don't really want to know what happened to the chicken that I'm eating, and I don't really want to know, you know, the kind of cages that, you know, layer hens are kept in. Because if I knew that, then I might not want to eat them, or I might want to spend more money, and I don't really have the money to spend, and I don't really want to spend double on chicken or not quit eating chicken or anything like that. And I think that a lot of these, you know, animal issues are very difficult because people do have eating habits that they're attached to, and, you know, they want to feed themselves and their families for an affordable price. And the foie gras issue lets you take a stand without it really actually impacting what you eat every day.
So you alluded to this a little bit, but we ought to go into detail since that's what so much of the book is about the production of foie gras.
Right.
The force feeding is always done with the tube. It's not like you can just put a duck in front of so much food and let it go to town.
Pretty much correct. There is a farmer in Spain named Eduardo Sousa who is marketing something called a humane foie gras, where he says that the geese are gorging themselves on these figs and olives on the land, but the production of that has been very spotty, and there are a lot of doubts on whether that's actually a viable alternative, and you know, some people don't believe it at all. And anyway, in terms of actual foie gras production that is, you know, classified as foie gras, it does involve a tube. I mean, I've seen this done at about 10 different farms, and it's done a little bit differently in the U.S. than it is in Canada or most places in France. In the U.S., the ducks live to about 12 weeks old, and like at Sonoma foie gras, they're actually outside. They're free-ranging. At Hudson Valley, they're inside, but in these pretty sizable barns. And at 12 weeks, which is an age that most ducks you eat already would have been killed, by the way, they're brought into these pens, and they're there for 2 to 4 weeks. It's usually about 2.5 weeks. It's a little longer at Hudson Valley. And twice a day, a feeder comes into the pen. There will maybe be 10 ducks or a dozen ducks in the pen, sit on a milk crate, and have this tube with sort of a funnel at the top. Take a scoop to put this corn feed into the funnel, a little auger that turns in it, and the guy takes the duck, puts it between his legs, lifts the beak up, you know, and then drops the tube down. And there's this kind of like, as you hear it going, the corn going down, lifts the tube back up. The duck kind of flaps its wings, moves on, and he takes the next duck. The ducks don't really react in a dramatic sort of way. And this is one of the things that I found striking and very strange, is that when you watch it being done, it's almost mundane. And that's not to say, oh, it's great, it's fine, everyone, you know, everyone loves it, but you don't have the sort of mythical, the ducks flapping to the feeder, please feed me, that you'll sometimes hear about. But you also don't have this really, really dramatic avoidance, like they're climbing over each other's injured bodies trying to get away, which is also how I've heard it described. You know, they'll feed one and then move on to the next one. And if you look at the pens where they've just been fed and the pens where they're about to be fed, you really can't tell which are which. There's really not much difference.
So when the ducks
take a few seconds at a time, and it's about twice a day.
So when the ducks see someone coming to feed them for, you know, the 10th day in a row, they're not cowering in the corner.
No, not really. And in fact, the ducks that have been in the feeding pens for a week longer, like the ones that have been in the feeding pens for like 3 days, are really getting out of the way more. And the ducks that have been there for longer are resisting less. And, you know, the theory on the foie gras side is, look, you know, the thing is that they've been kept outside, they've been in these spacious barns, and so they're not used to being in these pens, and they're not used to being handled. I mean, these aren't domestic animals. And so they're going to struggle more at first, but then they struggle less as they get used to it. And so they're obviously not being tortured. Now, the counter argument to that on the animal rights side is it's like Stockholm syndrome, and in fact, they've gotten used to their suffering, and they're resigned to it. But I've seen this in a lot of different places, and the ones that have been there longer definitely are struggling less, and they aren't kind of lying there looking depressed for whatever it is. You know, at the same time, veterinarians against foie gras say, Look, ducks don't show their pain.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that in just a minute. We have to take a quick break. Mark Caro is my guest. He's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. His new book is called The Foie Gras Wars, How a 5,000-Year-Old Delicacy Inspired the World's Fiercest Food Fight. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Mark Caro is my guest. He's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. His new book is called The Foie Gras Wars, How a 5,000-Year-Old Delicacy Inspired the World's Fiercest Food Fight. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Mark, back to what you were saying just now. There are people who are against the production of foie gras and this technique called gavage, by which they the ducks or the geese are force-fed, who say that because ducks have historically always been prey animals, they have sort of evolved not to show that they're in distress.
Right. Yeah, so they'll say, look, you expect the ducks aren't going to scream, they aren't going to show you that they're suffering. But in fact, they are. They're suffering in silence because they can't show you this, which makes it tricky when you're going to these farms and you're expecting to see the kind of, you know, horrific stuff that you do. If you go onto YouTube and you put foie gras in there are a lot of videos that have been put together that really show very distressing situations. And it's not to say that these aren't animals that were really suffering, but when you look at the whole of the animals, you don't see that. Now, another argument that's been made is, well, when I visited these farms, I've gotten the quote-unquote white glove tour, and any sick ducks were taken out of there. Basically, you know, especially when I was in France, and you know, there was this language barrier, and I was literally stopping in on some, you know, farms on the side of the road where they didn't know I was coming, a lot of it looked pretty much the same. Now, one of the differences in France is that the so-called industrial farms in France, they're not kept in pens, but they're kept in these individual cages, and you see that a lot when you see the videos where you'll have a duck and it's just like, it's almost like it's in a box and its head is sticking out and they could feed it that much quicker. And it seems like there are a lot of health issues that go along with that in terms of sores or just not being able to move around for 2.5 weeks. It's not the way it's done in the U.S. I think Hudson Valley foie gras experimented with doing that for some period of time, which is also being debated about. But they don't do that now. And again, it's a matter of, you go and look with your own eyes, and you're trying to figure out, well, what is the duck experiencing? And there are studies, and there are very credible people on both sides, you know, who will say, look, studies show that, in fact, there's no increase in stress on the duck and that all of our problems with this are anthropomorphizing. And, you know, if ducks, you know, you wouldn't have a 3% mortality rate, and you wouldn't be able to feed these ducks and get the livers if you were tearing their throats open, and they wouldn't be able to swallow whole fish either. You know, and on the other hand, you could say, look, there are plenty of, you know, studies that show that ducks have all these health problems because they're being force-fed, and also just use common sense. If your liver is getting to 8 to 10 times its normal size, you're going to have discomfort, and discomfort is something that, you know, doesn't go. I mean, the animal rights movement is very much about eliminating suffering. It's not about saying don't kill animals, because there are a lot of animals we kill and don't even think about or even know about, but it's, the problem is the suffering, and that's the argument on the animal rights side.
I know that the Chinese are significant producers of foie gras. Are we importing any? Do we know for a fact that when we buy it here, it comes from one of those three sort of humane farms that you described?
It definitely comes from, yeah, it's, I don't think it's coming from China. I know that China is doing it, and I know that there are people who would object to the use of the word humane, although, in fact, Hudson Valley foie gras is trying to get assessed as officially humane. But for the most part, when you get it, and certainly if you go into a restaurant, because it's not something that you tend to go get in the supermarket, if it's in the supermarket, it's certainly labeled, but it's likely to come from the U.S., and it'll be from Hudson Valley, LaBelle, or Sonoma, or it might come from one of the farms in Quebec, you know, one of the Canadian farms. And Rougier, which is in France, is the one French company that also exports to the U.S. So it would be one of those, but I don't think we're getting any. China's awfully far away, but I know that they have a pretty young foie gras industry, and they're trying to get it going there. And Japan is actually using foie gras a lot in cooking, so I don't know whether they're using more Chinese or if they're getting it from France, which is still by far the biggest producer of it.
Mark Caro is my guest. His new book is called The Foie Gras Wars. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Kent in Aledo. Hi, Kent.
Hi. I happen to have a flock of ducks. I raise ducks more as a hobby. I don't sell them commercially. But I know ducks really well because I'm with them every day. And I find your perspective kind of interesting because it's completely counter to what I know about ducks. Number one, if I put out corn, if I put out an unlimited amount of corn, my ducks would overindulge. They would gorge themselves on corn. And I think that's pretty typical. The fact that it's indicated that these ducks have to be forced to take corn in their craw doesn't make much sense to me at all. They have a craw that's visible. You can see they have a food bladder that's just inside the throat, going down to the right side of the chest. That bladder fills up when they're really full. My ducks stay full all the time because they eat a lot, and I have feeders out, and they eat what they want to eat. I can't imagine needing to force feed a duck because they're ravenous eaters.
Right. Well, it's interesting.
Second,
because
one other little point. They're also extremely vocal, and they do. If a duck bites another duck and they feel pain, they scream. If I have swans on my pond, if the ducks get too close to what the swans are eating, a swan might take a nip at a duck and grab him on the tail, causing a little pain, and the duck will scream. So, you know, all this business about suffering in silence, I'm wondering if you don't have some kind of maybe a hidden agenda here, because foie gras is food that's mostly eaten by the wealthy, and it sounds like social class war is what it sounds like.
Well, thanks for your call, Kent. Let's give Mark a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, well, to go backwards on that, it's interesting because when I was at Hudson Valley Foie Gras, Izzy Anae, who is the farmer out there, I was telling him about the anti-foie veterinarian had said about the ducks screaming. He said, look, come over here. And he took me into one of the barns where the ducks had been, you know, hadn't been there very long. And when he walked in, and they would go like, wah, 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 wah. And they made noise. He said, listen, they're screaming. You could tell that they're not happy because a human is in there and they're not used to people being around. And then when we went into the gavage area, you didn't hear that at all. There's also a difference. I think that females have, like, foie gras is actually always male ducks, and I think they lack voice boxes or something like that. So, like, females are much louder than males. But anyway, there was that point. And then the point about them eating a lot, there's actually a period called pre-gavage where a lot of food is put out for the ducks before they're even in the barns, and they will eat a lot. And I saw this at various farms, including this one in Minnesota, and the ducks will eat so much that you could see it kind of hanging down in their crops, and it's a way to where they're kind of getting themselves ready to eat more. I don't think they eat so much that their livers get to the size that foie gras is produced at, and that's why, you know, there's this sort of whole debate of is it natural or not. They say, well, they're natural. They have natural tendencies to eat a lot, especially if they're going to migrate. And also that the foie gras ducks are a specific breed that's been crossbred because they're very conducive to this, as opposed to probably the ducks that this gentleman is raising. But they'll get to a certain point, you know, naturally, and they're obviously being, you know, driven to a greater point through agriculture, so that you have this product that they then sell and people enjoy eating.
Well, you mentioned the breeding. I was going to ask you whether or not this issue could be resolved, at least to the satisfaction of some people, with husbandry. Can you genetically create a duck or a goose that has a larger liver to begin with?
Well, I think that they've genetically created one. Like, for instance, it used to be historically geese. And a lot of people talk about goose liver, goose foie gras, and duck foie gras. Even in France now, it's over 95% ducks. And part of the reason is because the breed of duck called the Moulard is a pretty sturdy duck that does well with these feedings, relatively speaking. I don't think that they've been able to come up with a breed that will eat so much that the liver will get so big that they don't need to use the tube. I think there have been various experiments on that. I don't think it's happened yet. If they could do it, I'm sure they would, because, you know, it would probably be easier. I mean, it's actually a pretty labor-intensive thing to have someone have to go and individually feed every single duck twice a day. It's much easier if you could just kind of throw out some feed or throw out some slop and have the animals eat themselves, which is one of the reasons it's so expensive.
We have an email here from Megan in Tyler, and the email address is think@kera.org. She says, isn't the core of this issue what is considered cruel treatment of animals? I'm a vegetarian and would never push my view on others, but I feel that what really matters is how the animal is treated prior to slaughter, and would ask people to consider what they think qualifies as humane treatment of animals. It does seem that we haven't fully answered that question for ourselves as a society.
I think she's right. Mm-hmm. I think that, and that's a lot of, I think, what the book is about, which is at where do you draw the line, and you know, what do you think is okay, and again, the people, you know, the farmer, like the guy at Hudson Valley, is ENA, he would say, look, you know, these ducks don't suffer. We take care of them. You know, they give us our livelihoods. I went to some little French farms where they say the same thing, and it was like, you know, a little goose farm, and I mean, the geese were, they were outside and they were treated very nicely, and the same guy who fed them carried them to slaughter, and slaughter is not a pretty thing to see no matter what. But you know, it certainly wasn't being done in a way where you would say, oh, this is torture, which is the word that is used. At the same time, you are exploiting an animal for a delicacy, and there are people who are going to have problems with that no matter what. But, you know, is there a way to be consistent about this, and where do you draw these lines? And, you know, for some people, being consistent is you become a vegetarian or a vegan, and then you're just not using them in that way. But there are, most people do not make that choice and do not find that to be the logical answer. And so, you know, how do we decide? And again, I find it interesting that, you know, I was able to visit all these foie gras farms and see this very controversial you know, feeding method. But if I want to go, when I asked about going to see how, say, chicken is produced, you know, absolutely not. You know, the stuff that we eat every day, there's very little transparency about. And in the factory farming, you know, world we live in, which gives people affordable food and helps, you know, which is an important thing, we're still not seeing it, and so we can't really make the educated decisions on, well, all right, is this okay as long as it's this price but not okay at that price? I mean, and I do try to spend a little bit more on, you know, some of the stuff that I think the animals are treated a little better, but I'm also still eating meat, so there are people who would have a problem with that.
So the foie gras people, as far as you could tell, didn't really hesitate to let you come and look at what they were doing?
No, for the most part they didn't, because there's been so much negative publicity. I mean, the thing is that you just tell someone, force feed a duck torture. I mean, the information war against foie gras has been very powerful, and most people think it sounds disgusting. I mean, it's doing something rude sounding to a duck to make its liver. I mean, people don't even like liver. It's just this perfect storm, and they don't like French stuff. I mean, we're talking about, you know, like this is in the sort of Freedom Fries era. Yeah, I mean, every sort of, it was like kind of this perfect storm against this, and so they were actually happy for me to come see, look, this is how we do it, and this is what it's like, and it's not this, you know, it's not what you're seeing on these videos, and it's not all of that. There was one farm called, there are three main farms, and one of them, La Belle, which is really close to Hudson Valley, foie gras in upstate New York, had me come all the way out there and then wouldn't let me see anything and wouldn't talk to me. And so that was fine. I saw enough at other places, so, you know, anyone could draw their own conclusions about why they don't want me to see what they're doing. But, you know, most of them did. And when I was in France, people were very open, and they really wanted me to see it because they feel like it's this artisan tradition that's centuries old, if not more. And they're afraid it's going away, like, you know, traditions in the U.S. are going away with small farms.
Are the French losing any sleep over this issue?
They're losing a little bit more over it than I expected them to. The thing is that in France, they're much more connected to the agricultural way of life than we are, where almost everyone there has a brother or a cousin or someone who actually has worked on a farm, and often, you know, a farm that did foie gras. And so they don't have this disconnect of where their food comes from that we do here. And also just foie gras is so much part of the culture as well. But there is a movement against it there based on animal rights. And the France actually passed something where they declared foie gras to be part of their national patrimony, and that was a few years ago. And I think part of that is because in Europe there are other countries that have banned the production of foie gras. These are countries that weren't producing it in the first place, but you'll hear that a dozen European countries have banned it. But they all still sell it because of the EU rules, and you know, the European Union allows the free sale of all these, you know, items. But I think that there's some fear that at some point, if the European Union tries to move against it this way, there may be protecting it. And there's actually a ban on those individual cages I mentioned that's supposed to take effect, but not until 2015. And there's a sense that a lot of people support the kind of small farm way of life, but maybe don't support the so-called industrial production. And, you know, if the small farm version goes away and it all becomes industrial, maybe it becomes easier to oppose overall. So it's complex even there, and I thought it would be less so.
Mark Caro is my guest. His new book is called The Foie Gras Wars. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Tim in Fort Worth. Hello, Tim.
Hey, how are you? Mark, I'm excited to read the book, and I think you've touched on this just a little bit in your previous comments. Growing up in Texas, you get a little bit of the country, a little bit of the city point of view on how to treat animals and that sort of thing. And I think the example I was discussing earlier was that I've seen out in my part of the woods folks that have their dogs in very small kennels out in the yard with dead squirrels hanging in them to teach them how to, I assume, to teach them how to say squirrels, and it seems like there might be better ways to do that nowadays, but I'm no expert. My question is do you find that there's like a generational difference in the point of view of how people would approach a delicacy or even the treatment of the animals? In other words, would people who are a little younger and maybe a little more squeamish about mistreating an animal in any way versus maybe people who are a little bit more attached to the old way of doing things? Or is it more geographic, just people from farms and country and being in the country and associated with animals? I mean, am I making sense?
Yeah, it seems like you can break that down in a couple different ways. I mean, in France, where there are many more farmers doing this, there seems to be a generational thing in that the young generation isn't really staying on the farm and wanting to do this. So you get the sense that it's more supported by the older, you know, the people in their 40s or their 60s. And it's hard to tell, you know, what's going to happen there. Here, there just aren't that many farmers doing it. But what I find interesting from a generational point of view is that young people have these two things going on at the same time that are sort of complementary and also sort of in conflict, which is that you have the rise of this consciousness of wanting to know where your food comes from. And that's why places like Whole Foods, which, you know, was originally just, you know, a little specialty store down in Austin, is now, you know, a huge supermarket chain. People do all their shopping there, even though it's very expensive and everything. And there are other, you know, chains like it. But at the same time, you also have the rise of the food culture. And there are all these food bloggers, and there are people who watch Top Chef and Iron Chef and the Food Network. And there's this growing sense of interest in, you know, gourmet ingredients and the different taste sensations. And foie gras fits in there, too. And so you have both these things going on at the same time with young people. And so I think that's why there's a lot of interest in it.
Mark Caro is my guest. He's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, whose new book is called The Foie Gras Wars, How a 5,000-Year-Old Delicacy Inspired the World's Fiercest Food Fight. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Reporter Mark Caro is my guest. His new book is called The Foie Gras Wars, How a 5,000-Year-Old Delicacy Inspired the World's Fiercest Food Fight. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I think, as is our nature as Americans, Mark, anytime some of us hear that something's not going to be available anymore, it creates this like vast and overwhelming demand for the product. Can you talk about the response to what turned out to be a temporary ban in Chicago, but in other places as well?
Right. Yeah. Well, you had foie gras prohibition in Chicago and duck easies and places where you would sort of buy it on the fly. And what happened was that Chicago banned foie gras as of April of 2006. And this was after Loretta Swit, who played Hot Lips on MASH, had come in and testified to the Chicago City Council comparing the foie gras ducks to the prisoners at Abu Ghraib. It finally passed by being put into an omnibus bill, and which was basically just like a big bill in which the city deals with a lot of small items that are non-controversial. And all of a sudden, foie gras was banned. And a lot of restaurants rebelled. First, the day that it went into effect, all these restaurants rebelled, and they're putting it on pizzas and in soul food and on hot dogs. And then after, you know, the law was supposedly being enforced, you had restaurants saying, well, all right, we'll sell you this honey apricot terrine for $16 with the foie gras for free, basically, because then we're not selling it to you anymore. You would have restaurants with you know, fixed prices, and they would say, well, we're giving you the foie gras, so you're not paying for it. And then you had these underground supper clubs. There's one called Turtle Soup that I went to a couple things for, where they would serve a foie gras dinner at a restaurant, give you a card, and if you took this card into another restaurant and handed it to them and say, I'll have the turtle soup, please, they would
sort of wink at you and bring you a foie gras appetizer. That was how it was supposed to work, at least.
And somebody tried to make foie gras cotton candy?
Yeah, and then I was at this this underground dinner where it was a forbidden, completely underground, where you wouldn't get the location of it until that day, and you would drive there, and this chef was doing a four-course foie gras dinner, and he really hadn't cooked with foie gras much before, and he thought that by doing this dinner would help him figure out the ethical issues, and he had a foie gras gnocchi, and he also had a foie gras cotton candy, but he hadn't really tried making it before this dinner and discovered that, in fact, if you mix sugar with raw liver and put it into a cotton candy machine, you don't get foie gras cotton candy. You get this kind of wet, mushy brown stuff spinning around a lot. And he finally ended up taking it out and putting it on the stovetop and making foie gras caramel with it instead, which frankly didn't taste a whole lot like foie gras.
It doesn't sound like a good idea, regardless of who's at the stove.
No, I mean, again, part of the thing with doing this book is that on one hand there are all these, you know, very serious issues where it really kind of probes, you know, well, how do we feel about food and animals and all of this? But on the other hand, I mean, it's a real story, and they're really very, I mean, some of it is just funny, and if you just take a step back, and I'm sorry, foie gras cotton candy strikes me as funny. So, you know, you have this very intense fight going on about duck livers, and if you're able to sort of think that things are funny and serious at the same time, you know, which I did, it sort of helped me, you know, get through it. And you have very colorful characters who are, you know, whether you have, animal rights people who are, you know, some are very, you know, mild-mannered, and others have bullhorns in front of restaurants calling the owners, you know, duck rapists. So it's just, there's a big variety of the way people react to this thing.
We have an email from Ed who says, almost no one among those finding fault with the eating habits of others has tested his or her own ethics by confronting the taking of a life to feed himself or herself. Sorry to say it, but one who has no stake in the ethics of a matter is unimportant in the discussion of those ethics. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, you know, again, that's a broad thing to say about anyone who eats meat, frankly, which is that we're so disconnected from it. And if, you know, again, one of the common lines is, look, if you went to a slaughterhouse and saw, you know, cows being slaughtered, you wouldn't want to eat beef, or if you saw the way chickens live or die, you wouldn't want to see that either. And frankly, I wish that we could see more of it. I think that we would make more informed decisions. I mean, there are a lot of people in this country who are on farms and who have taken lives, or who are hunters for that matter, which I'm not one of. When I was in France, you know, I went to a couple farms where, you know, you would just eat what they got off of the farm, and they were very connected to it, and they seemed very appreciative of the animals that they had, and the geese or the ducks, and, you know, they would take care of them, and they would feed them, and they would slaughter them, and they would eat them and use every part of it, because it was what they were, you know, surviving on, and also what they were, you know, using to make a living, which seems like a healthy approach, you know, even though there are some people who are going to say, well, you know, they shouldn't be doing that to the ducks regardless. But that seems like it's certainly not an attitude you can criticize, and that they're at least in touch with it, whereas we seem so disconnected from it so much of the time.
Let's go back to the phones now and speak with Lauren in Denton. Hey, Lauren.
Hey, I have a question for your guest. He talked about the cost of foie gras being driven by the manpower used in the two-day feedings, and also how they were looking to, like, genetically select for a duck that would maybe grow a bigger liver. And my question is, well, what if you just took the manpower out of it, let the ducks eat their full heads off the way the guy from Argyle or whatever said his ducks will do, and harvested those livers? They would be smaller, but your cost would be much lower. Would those livers not constitute foie gras?
Yeah, they wouldn't. I mean, because it's been tried. It's interesting. There's a goose farm in South Dakota called Schultz Goose Farm, and they decided that they realized that the geese that they were harvesting later in the year had much bigger livers and than the ones earlier in the year, because they were just eating more at that time, and, you know, in the fall. And they were like 2 to 3 times the normal size. And they just tried selling it as fatty goose liver. And so, of course, in doing the research of this book, I bought some, and I actually sent it to a very, very well-regarded chef to try to cook it up, and it just didn't work. It still had this kind of harsh, metallic, almost metallic kind of flavor. I mean, the thing with foie gras is that when you think of liver is a pretty strong ingredient. And foie gras, because it's so full of fat, is much milder, and it has this... It's just a different experience, and I think if a farm could market it without without having to, you know, feed the ducks, and they could keep the cost lower and have more people want it because it's cheaper, I think that would be their benefit as well. But they have not been able to create that product from doing that.
We have an email here from Willow who says, even if you choose to believe it isn't torture to inflict the unfamiliar stress of force feeding on an animal who cannot possibly comprehend why it's being done, and that the animal feels no ill effects from its organs becoming engorged, you can't possibly claim that the process is humane. So why does anyone need to eat foie gras? Did you come to an understanding of that question?
Well, it's interesting because that argument can be expanded on in all of meat again. And in fact, in Israel, which is the one place that banned it that actually was producing it in terms of being a country, it kind of hinged on this one justice saying, we could ban it because it's a luxury item, whereas if it were a staple, it wouldn't be necessary. And this one, you know, lawyer in New York who does work for Farm Sanctuary and who is a vegetarian said, you know, we applaud this measure, but by logic, it really isn't consistent, because if you're a vegan or you're a vegetarian, you don't think that any meat is necessary. And, you know, one of the arguments is, you know, like if you distinguish between what's a luxury item or not, then what is say veal? And I don't personally eat veal, but, you know, it's part of a cow. And, you know, how do you draw those lines? I mean, I think to just say that, you know, to somehow justify that a chicken McNugget is okay despite whatever is in it, but, you know, this old delicacy that brings people a lot of pleasure is not because, you know, just on the basis of how necessary it is, that doesn't seem to me to be the fair standard. If it brings people, you know, a great amount of pleasure, whether it's a small group or a large group, I think that you have that right to take that pleasure from it. But that's not to say that has any bearing on whether the animal, how the animal is being treated. I think they're separate issues. But I don't think that you should get rid of it just because, you know, it's something that, like, some rich foodies like.
You mentioned that Wolfgang Puck and some other prominent chefs have stopped serving it, taking it off their menus. Do you think that's a factor of political pressure or of them having a genuine change of heart?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, Stephen Starr is a restaurateur in Philadelphia who has a lot of restaurants, and he took it off his menus after they started protesting his house. And Wolfgang Puck, they had pickets outside of Spago. They had a very aggressive internet campaign. And he was someone who was a real champion of it. Now, he says that he just came around and he made it part of a holistic policy he was going to have where he was not going to serve anything that he felt was inhumane. And so it wasn't just the foie gras, it was everything. Now, he didn't want to be interviewed for this book, you know, to talk about this, policy that he had. There are others who have worked with him who think that he completely sold out and that he did it because he was bowing to political pressure. I'm sure he wouldn't say so if I talked to him, but I also think it's, you know, he didn't want to talk about it. So there you go.
Let's go next to Regina in Dallas. Hello, Regina.
Yes, I have a question, please. Fabulous book. I can't wait to buy it. But I'd always heard that 80% of the foie gras in the United States was actually from China. And the way that they produced it there is they cut off the beaks and they cut off the feet of the little ducklings and they put them in little tiny boxes. And it was so inhumane to me that I have never eaten foie gras again.
What do you know about that, Mark?
I did not go to China, but I don't know of any. I've never seen Chinese foie gras on a menu in the U.S. I don't really see why. I mean, there's not such a huge demand that you would need to get it from China and the farms. I mean, the farms in, you know, the U.S. wish that there were more orders for it so they could produce more, especially right now. I mean, that's one of the things that's hurting foie gras is the economy and high-end dining. I have not seen it. I doubt they're chopping their feet off. That doesn't sound like it would make it. Ducks need to stand, so I don't see that happening. I've heard of, you know, debeaking where some you know, birds will have, like, the tips of their beaks cut off, which is something that happens, you know, whether it's, you know, foie gras production or just regular chicken production or anything. I don't know that much about it, so I don't want to be, you know, for the record on that. But I've not seen the production in China. I don't think it's. I would love if someone knows that it's in fact being produced, being imported here. I'd love to hear about it. But I think that most of it is fresh liver, and it's easier to get fresh liver from, you know, somewhere else in the U.S. than to get it from all the way from China. And I think the product here is also considered to just be better. So I wouldn't make the idea of it being from China be the basis of whether you have it or not.
Of all the people that you interviewed for the book, Mark, was there someone that tended to be the most objective on the issue? Because it's such a polarizing debate.
Well, objective is an interesting point because everyone kind of comes into it with their own perspective. So I try to be the objective one, but I also don't hide about, you know, I don't try to pretend like I'm not having personal reactions to this stuff, and I try to let people know where I'm coming, and I try to sort of take you through it. I think it's interesting that like at Hudson Valley Foie Gras, you have Izzy Yanay, who's the farmer who really is very strident about it. He looks like James Caan and sounds like Jackie Mason. He's very much like, these ducks do not suffer. And you know, he says he's lived with them for, you know, decades, and he's just convinced and that this is just not a harmful process. And then you talk to Michael Ganor, who is not actually on the farm and was very instrumental in kind of popularizing it and sort of getting this to the chefs like Thomas Keller and all these other guys. And he's much more sort of down the line, like much more philosophical about it, saying, you know, I'm not sure that everything we do to animals is really great, and I'm not sure that the ducks don't suffer like as an absolute, but he also doesn't think that they suffer any more than in any other, you know, agriculture, and that says that once you're taking animals in and putting them into a production system, there's obviously going to be things that happen to them that are contrary to their own best interests. But given that, he's comfortable with it. You know, and then Izzy will say, look, you know, if you have like animals out in the wild, they're getting eaten alive by other animals. And so, you know, the foie gras, his ducks are happier than, you know, the duck would be if it was just kind of out being preyed upon. So
have we come to a point in our maybe collective consciousness where we need to think about all of our food as a moral issue?
Well, I think it's just good to, it's good to weigh these, it's good to know what you're talking about. And one of the themes in the book is how a lot of people who really spout off on this, including a lot of the politicians, really don't know what they're talking about and really don't research it. And a lot of it's just how we discuss these things. And we definitely could evolve in terms of really having the facts at our fingertips. And so that I don't think that everything has to be an agonizing decision. You know, you shouldn't have to be under tremendous stress every time you go out to eat, you know, lunch or dinner or something like that. I mean, we should be able to eat and have confidence without worrying all the time, which we do anyway for, you know, salmonella and hormones and, you know, all of these health issues. And so it's kind of, food has become stressful anyway. It would be good to feel like you're making solid, ethical, moral decisions when you eat. And it would certainly be helpful if everyone felt like they had more information, which requires them wanting to have the information too.
Mark Caro is a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. His new book is called The Foie Gras Wars, How a 5,000-Year-Old Delicacy Inspired the World's Fiercest Food Fight. Mark, it's been so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. This was great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.